This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My name is Germ. This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas. Dr. Stuart Fishbein, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Germ, thank you for having me across the world. It's always a great pleasure for me to be able to meet new people and speak to an audience that may not necessarily hear what I have to say. So thank you for this opportunity.
I think what you have to say is a whole lot more important than I actually realized. And I was joking now before we were recording, it's because my wife's pregnant. I would never have thought about this.
Yeah, it's not a guy topic. It's really rare when I speak to more than one or two men in the room. And whenever I speak, it's almost always women. So it's, again, it's another pleasure for two men to be talking on this subject, which I'm so passionate about. And you are, obviously, now that you're going to be a father. It changes everything. Everything for you will change.
Just on that, we always hear the same sort of woke nonsense. But you're men. You can't speak about things like pregnancy and birth.
Yeah. It's a silly ideology. You know, in my country, we're very woke, if that's a term that you guys use in South Africa. We're very intersectionality oriented. There was a push at one meeting a few years ago down in San Diego, California, where the African-American midwives took the microphone away from the old granny white midwives. They said that Black women should only be taken care of by Black midwives. And, and if you use that logic, you extend it to the point where that means Chinese women should only be taken care of by Chinese midwives and white women should only be taken care of white midwives. And it's stupid. It's what's taught these days in what passes for higher learning. But there's a belief that I have that the farther you go in academia, the dumber you get. You know, there was a guy named William Buckley. He ran a television show in the 60s and 70s, I think, on public television here in the United States. He was a conservative with a British type accent, and he had true conservatives versus true liberals on the show. And he would debate back and forth. And one of the things he said once, which has stuck with me forever, is he said he'd rather be governed by the first 500 names in the Boston phone book than the entire faculty of Harvard University. And, you know, basically imply there's more common sense in the plumbers and the carpenters and the homemakers than there are in people in academia. And I think that that's true. So people who say that, you know, if this turns them off because I'm a male speaking about female things, they need to be prepared for the fact that if they're a female speaking about male urology or male diseases or anything like that, then we shouldn't be listening to them. It makes no sense. And so I just ignore these people. There's always going to be people out there who, instead of arguing what I say, will argue that I'm not qualified to say it or that I'm, you know, I'm not this or I'm not that. And they attack you pejoratively as opposed to attack your substance. I'd be willing to debate anybody on the topics that you and I are about to probably discuss.
Well, I mean, you are qualified. Let's talk about your background and your backstory.
Well, I'll try to give a brief version of it. Otherwise, it'll take up a good chunk of the podcast. you know, I grew up in the Midwestern part of the United States, a place called Minnesota. And I went to college there, and I had no direction as a 18, 19-year-old kid. I had no real direction. And in my third year of college, some of my friends were going pre-medical, and I decided that I could do that. So I was already taking the science courses anyway. I'd already taken organic chemistry and physics and calculus and things that came relatively easy to me. And so I got into medical school at the University of Minnesota. The first 2 years are mostly classroom and laboratory and anatomy lab. And then the second 2 years are mostly rotations in the clinical subspecialties. So you do things like internal medicine, pediatrics, OBGYN, neurology, and then you have electives like ear, nose, and throat, dermatology, radiology, and, you know, and then at some time in the end of your third year, early fourth year, and you are absolutely not prepared to make a life decision like this, you have to choose what specialty you're going to go into and probably do that the rest of your life. It's one of those sliding door moments where you make a decision to go into OBGYN, which is what I did. And the reason I did that was just serendipitous. I had just come off a rotation on hematology and oncology, which was a cancer service for children, pediatrics. And it was very depressing for me. And the next rotation I did was catching babies at 3 a.m. And I really just loved that. And I thought, well, you know, what I really wanted, what I really liked about medicine was what's called longitudinal care. And that's taking care of people over time. And there's only three specialties, Germ, that do that. And that is internal medicine, family practice, and OBGYN. And the advantages of OBGYN were that you get to do some surgery, you get to do endocrinology, you get to do a little psychiatry, you get to do lots of different things, but you also get to catch babies. For me, that was an easy decision. And of course, at that point in my life, you know, you're enthusiastic, you're naive, you don't know anything, and you don't think about the hours, the liability, the system itself. And of course, the system was completely different in the early 1980s when I was applying for residency programs, as opposed to what it is in 2024. I ended up matching my residency in Southern California at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, which is a big medical center in Southern California. And I had the good fortune of being in that residency, which had a collaborative relationship with University of Southern California Women's Hospital, which at that point in the early 80s was the busiest hospital in the United States, doing about 22,000 births a year. And if you break that down, that's about 65 babies a day. And I'm there for 4 months every other day. So that's 60 days at 65 babies a day. That's 3,600 and some births that you see. Every day I'm going to see two or three breaches statistically. Every day I'm going to see two or three twins statistically. It was just considered a variation of normal. We gathered skills that they no longer teach anymore. And I came out of training extremely well trained in the skills of OBGYN, but had no experience whatsoever in normal birthing. And this is a problem that almost every resident gets. If some of your listeners would ever to watch the documentary, The Business of Being Born by Abby Epstein and Ricky Lake, they'll get an idea of the kind of thing that medical residents do not see normal birthing. So we come out as experts, but we are not expert in about 80% of women, which is, you know, women who don't really need medical care. We'll talk about your country in a little bit, but this was back in the 80s. So I was very medicalized. But one of the other good serendipitous moments for me was that I was approached early in my career by some local midwives in Southern California and asked to take their home birth transports. And I said, yes, I'd be happy to do that, but not because I thought home birth was a good idea or not because I knew anything about midwifery. I did it because I was trying to make money. Medicine was a different world again. I keep saying that, but it was completely different 40 years ago. You didn't come out and get a job working for somebody and make a salary and work a shift. You came out and built your practice from scratch. That type of practice is disappearing from the planet as medicine becomes more under corporate control, which is one of the worst things that could possibly ever happen because it gives the doctor a conflict of interest now because my fiduciary duty should be to my patient. And by the way, we call them clients because most pregnant women are not sick. Patient defines a woman who is sick. So you might hear me use the term client periodically, and that's what I do. But they're not sick, so we are not really well-trained to take care of these women, and yet we are supposedly the experts. I came out and thinking that I'm just going to try to make money that way, but it changed me because I began to hear from the women who were coming in, mainly non for emergency stuff, but just for pain relief or exhaustion, and they just needed an epidural and they needed some Pitocin and they would end up having vaginal deliveries, and I'd have a lot of time to talk with them and then talk with the midwives, and I began to hear a different way of doing things, and I began to take an interest in it, and I was invited to some of their events, and I began to go to their events, and I became very popular backing up midwives. And after about 10 years of doing that, I started my own collaborative midwifery practice at another hospital in north of Los Angeles. And for 15 years, we had a really good thing going on. The midwives did all the normal stuff, and I took care of all the so-called abnormal stuff. So if a woman had a well woman exam or needed a prenatal visit or needed birth control or that sort of thing, the midwives did that. And if she had an abnormal pap smear or had an ectopic pregnancy or needed a breech delivery or a C-section, then I would do that. And we were in a community that was very hostile to us. We had a C-section rate of 7%. We took all comers. Other groups in the community had C-section rates in the mid-20%, which in the 90s was the normal rate. It's now in my country up to 32, 33%. In your country, you just told me earlier that it's up to 80%, which is insane. And I hope we get a chance to talk about that in a minute. Mm. But after 15 years, they pushed us out. They banned the midwives. They banned vaginal birth after cesarean. They banned breech delivery. And eventually, they weren't going to renew my privileges because they have the right to do that. And I wasn't looking for a legal challenge to fight a hospital that doesn't want me there anyway. So I started doing home births under the encouragement of my own patients and the midwives that I had been working with for 25 years at that point. And for the last 13, 14 years of my career, I've been dealing with home birthing and I've loved it. And I got bolder as we went along and I started doing breech deliveries at home and twin deliveries at home and type 1 diabetics at home. And realized that pretty much everything I learned in my training is wrong for most women. Most women don't need anything from the medical community. And yet the medical community dominates how women see their bodies, see birth, and they've captured it. They control it. And it's about power and it's about money. And it should be about outcomes, but we're doing worse now than we have ever in my lifetime. I mean, in 1970, the C-section rate in my country, probably your country, was in the single digits. Now it's crazy what your country's doing. And yet, are the outcomes for babies and mothers any better? And the answer is no, they're not. The rates of cerebral palsy, the rates of neonatal death, the rates of maternal mortality have not dropped. If anything, they've gone up a little bit. I don't know the details in your country and what it was like, because your country was different back in the 80s as well. There were a lot of different things going on. But it's certainly, when you think about what's going on right now, the model that's in power, if we were all sane, we would say, you know what, this isn't working. Let's not do more of it. Let's change our course. But there's too many people invested in it. And so we are in a mess right now. And women and birthing has never been in a worse place than it is right now. And there are people who cling to it as the only model. It's a form of cognitive dissonance to believe that your model can be safety, and that anybody else who's doing something is unsafe and therefore needs to be pounded out and ridiculed. If you look at papers throughout the world, and you don't really need a paper to do this, there are no real studies that show that hospital birthing is better than home birthing, that home birthing, the outcomes are better. If you talk about a group of low risk, similar cohorts of women, there's lower rates of interventions, lower rates of C-sections, lower rates of episiotomies, higher rates of satisfaction, higher rates of breastfeeding, lower chances of babies going to the NICU in the midwifery home birth model than there are in the hospital model. The problem, of course, is that the hospital model runs everything, so they control everything. And they control the media, and they control what you hear. And when a plane crashes, you hear about it. When a million planes land safely, you don't hear about it. So when there's a bad outcome at home, it makes the news. When there's bad outcomes in the hospital, pretty much every day, no one ever knows about it. Or they just say, well, we did everything we could, and we ended up with a bad outcome. I guess that's just expected in the hospital because birth is dangerous. No, birth isn't necessarily dangerous for most women. The model by which they're cared for in the hospital makes it more dangerous. Yes, for some percentage of women, they have problems that the medical system is perfect at. Our medical system, your medical system, is great at acute problems. In other words, if you break your arm, they're good at setting your bone. If you have a ruptured appendix, they're good at doing that. If you have an abruption of your placenta, they're good at taking care of that. They're good at that. But they're not good at understanding that birth is a normal function of a woman's body. And when it's left alone, it works perfectly most of the time, very similar to breathing or digestion. Conceiving, growing a baby, and giving birth is something that your body will do without you thinking about it. Your body just does it. The same thing with pregnancy. But when your body does start, when your mind starts to override your primitive instincts, like when you have to give a speech, and so you hyperventilate, or you get stomach cramps because you're now screwing up your digestion because you're nervous because you have a big exam tomorrow, or you have to go to court or something, and it makes you nervous and you get upset stomach. This is your body overriding its normal functions. This is what happens when you instill fear into the world of obstetrics. When you leave birth alone and you properly select the women, those things rarely go wrong suddenly. Rarely do you see the rapid deterioration of fetal status that you see in the hospital because a woman has been brought in not in labor for an unnecessary induction. She's immobilized. She's starved. She's interrupted constantly. She's given artificial stimulation to her uterus. She can't move to deal with the discomfort, so they give her an epidural. Epidural disconnects her from her baby. Her baby's heart rate suddenly starts to have patterns that the doctors don't like, and they do a C-section on her for fetal intolerance of labor. And then they say something really stupid like, wow, thank God you were here, because what if this had happened at home? But this stuff doesn't happen at home, except on very rare occasions. And the idea that we're going to have perfect outcomes in any setting is wrong. Now, for some people, they believe the hospital is the safest place to give birth. That's fine, as long as they've been given true information so they can make an informed decision. But for many people, the hospital is the least safe place to give birth. Every other mammal germ doesn't go to a place where there's a whole bunch of people running around or other animals running around checking on them constantly. They go to a place where they could be safe, quiet, and unobserved.
And not on their back.
and not on their back. You know, they can move, they can roll, they can get up, they can pace, they can drink if they're thirsty, they can eat if they're hungry. Imagine that. They are not constantly interrupted for protocol dictated procedures. Like, I have to take your blood pressure every hour. Why? Well, because someone in administration said we have to chart it every hour. So I have to put this thing on your arm every hour and blow it up and bother you. I mean, silly things like that, that we all take for granted as normal. God, I could go off on all sorts of tangents here. My brain is so full of things. But anyway, yes. And occasionally something will go wrong at home. And that's why having a smooth transition to a hospital setting would be ideal, rather than the hostility that occurs with a lot of hospitals and doctors not willing to accept these women's choices. Again, there's a patriarchy in obstetrics that believes that only the doctor knows best. You can look at black and white films from the 50s about, you know, birth, and it's, the language is hilarious. You may think that you have this idea, but you know what? Listen to your doctor. Your doctor knows best. And your doctor was always a he back then. Now, listen, about 80% of OBGYNs are probably female. And the patriarchy hasn't gotten less. So all it's proven by having females in OBGYN is they can be just as patriarchal because they're not changing it for the better.
Dr. Stu, if I'm following you correctly, you're suggesting that there's an over-medicalization of childbirth, and it's also driven by a combination of profit and fear. Is that correct?
That would be exactly correct. Those are the two most powerful motives for why we have a system that is the way it is. If we could remove both of those from the system and we rewarded not doing something, if we could bill for not giving a hepatitis vaccine, then hospitals would probably back off on demanding women get a hepatitis vaccine for their baby. If we paid more for a vaginal birth than we did for cesarean birth, if we paid less for induction than we did for someone in natural labor, maybe we'd see more natural labors and vaginal births. When the system pays more for more interventions, you're going to see more interventions. And how do you drive a woman to be intervened upon? You scare her. You tell her stupid stuff. Oh my God, you're over 35. At their very first visit, they're 10 weeks pregnant at their very first visit. And the doctor's talking about their age and being how high risk this could be and your placenta might give out. I don't think the doctors realize this. I think there's a lack of self-awareness in what the words that come out of their mouth. Because there's no reason at 10 weeks pregnant to tell a woman, you know, God, you have narrow hips. So there's a chance your baby could be not fit through your pelvis. Why are you telling her that? Because you're projecting your anxieties upon the women that you're caring for. That's what you're doing. You don't even know you're doing it. And you think that that's informed and that's giving information so they can make informed consent. It's not, because they only tell them the downsides of, say, a breech vaginal delivery, but they don't tell them the downsides of a cesarean section. They tell them the benefits of an epidural. They don't tell them the downsides of an epidural. So they skew their counseling. This is coercion of a subtle form. There's overt coercion, pulling out the your baby will die if you don't do this card. But there's very subtle coercion, and it goes on in every doctor's office all the time. And some of it's motivated by fear in the doctor as much as in the woman. And a lot of it's motivated by profit margin. The more hospitals do, the more money they make. So why would they do less? If I was the chief financial officer of a hospital, why would I want to lower my C-section rate? Because I'm a good person? Well, screw that. Your fiduciary duty is to your hospital entity that you work for.
But let me play devil's advocate. Most of the women in our circles will say, well, I had a C-section because there was X and X going wrong, or there was this, it was an emergency or something. And there's always a reason.
Sure. I mean, doctors are very good at giving women fear. And then the solution to fear is to have the baby in the bassinet. Let's just get the baby out. Not really caring what happens to that baby in the long run. Things that can occur to a baby that's born by a pre-labor scheduled C-section. A baby that doesn't experience labor, that doesn't go through the reflexes and the trials and the difficulties of labor and to come out stronger on the other side. A baby that's disconnected from its mother's hormones, that never gets bathed in its mother's oxytocin during labor. Oxytocin, that bonding hormone, that hormone that binds us all together, that our love hormone. And maybe we have lots of problems and down the road because we alter the microbiome. We know that probably 80% of our immune system comes from our gut. Our gut is colonized by mom's bacteria. And when that bacteria is bypassed, our gut is often colonized by hospital-based bacteria. And then we see all kinds of potential problems down the road with that. I mean, we have chronic illnesses in children now, over 50% in my country. I'm sure it's probably just as high in your country. When it used to be single digits when I first started in medicine. So the C-section rate when I first started in medicine was like 8-9%. And now the C-section rate is really high. And now the chronic disease rate in children is really high. Now, of course, there's lots of other factors involved in that. But can you exclude the fact that we're birthing babies not by nature's design, something that was designed over eons? It's a very intelligent design. It really isn't smart to grow a baby inside of you that can't fit out. Nature really wouldn't do that.
Yeah, it sounds stupid.
It does. Yeah. Well, if it sounds stupid, it is stupid. What we've lost in medicine is common sense. So playing devil's advocate and saying that yeah, all those C-sections, they're told that something is wrong. But here's a clue. When a woman tells you she had an emergency C-section germ, ask her, from the time they made the decision to do the C-section until they did the C-section, how much time passed? And if they say, oh, it's about 45 minutes, well, then that wasn't an emergency. But they were told it was an emergency. So there's a lot of things that you're told. If people haven't woken up in the last 3-4 years about being gaslit by medical system, they're never going to wake up. I find the history of medicine fascinating, and I've taken a fairly deep dive in the last few years into the history of heavy metals and vaccines and things like that, because I found a real interest in that. I mean, turn of the 20th century, they had mercury in baby's teething powder.
Mercury?
Yeah, mercury. What could go wrong? They were spraying heavy metals, on our food and our vegetation. They told us that thalidomide was good for you, and that twilight sleep and forceps were good for you, and that diethylstilbestrol was good for you, and that the food pyramid was upside down, and that, you know, take Tylenol because that's good for you and that's easy to pain relief, not understanding the effects of Tylenol has on fetuses and young babies. Even adults shouldn't be taking Tylenol. Pretty much everything they've told you has another side to it that they've pounded into oblivion because their model has increased their power and their profit. And again, back to using fear, it's how they control us. A woman with a baby inside of her, it's her whole life. She wants nothing more than that baby to be safe. And doctors have abused their power. And again, I'm not talking about the individual doctor who's like basically a hamster in a wheel. I'm talking about the system that they work in has lost its way, and they don't realize it, or maybe it's headless and it can't be changed because there's too many forces that are pushing it one way or the other. But those ideas, when you hear someone say, well, what if this happens at home and what if that happens at home? Those are understandable things and they need to be explained. They don't need to be ridiculed like saying, well, home delivery is for pizza, that sort of thing. That kind of statement tells you that doctor doesn't know anything. And I would tell the women that are listening to your podcast to remember that they are the consumer. When they go see their obstetrician for their first time, choose wisely. Interview them. Don't let them examine you. Don't let them draw any blood. Go in for your first visit and interview them. Ask them questions like, well, how do you feel about if I get to past 40 weeks? What happens? How do you feel about what if my baby's breech? How do you feel about the ARRIVE trial inducing everybody at 39 weeks? Just sound them out and see when you leave their office, do you feel reassured? Or do you feel like a little less safe? And then maybe don't go back there. Trust your gut. Trust your instinct. Don't keep going back to a place that doesn't treat you well. You would never go back to the same restaurant if they mistreated you every time you went there. But yet you go back to the same doctor's office to wait 40 minutes for your 6-minute office visit. Why would you keep doing that?
You spend a bit of time on C-sections, and a number of women that I know would say, well, I agree. You know, I don't like the idea of a C-section. And for whatever reason, it was an emergency and I needed to have one. And you've covered some of that. But what about the other medical interventions? I get the feeling that there's a cascading set of events that tends to occur, which eventually leads to a C-section. It will start off with something small, like the doctor saying, well, the head might be a bit big, so let's just keep an eye on that. And then you end up at cutting, and then you end up at a drip, and you end up at this injection and that injection, and eventually on epidural, and eventually end up at C-section, right?
Yes.
Is that kind of what happens?
Yes. That's called the cascade of interventions, and everybody who knows OB knows about that. And the whole medical system is not designed for wellness. It's designed for pathology. And so every test that they want you to do, they don't tell you that there's problems with that test as far as false positives, and it may lead you to further testing, and then being anxious, and then bathing your baby in cortisol and adrenaline as opposed to oxytocin and endorphins, because now throughout the pregnancy you're worried. For instance, we talked about the baby's head might be a little too big, or maybe maybe the fluid's a little bit low. All right. Well, is it low or is it normal? Because there's a wide range of normal amniotic fluid, and yet a doctor will say it's on the low end. The low end is still normal because fluid, like everything else, is on a bell-shaped curve. It means that some people have to be on the high end and some people have to be on the low end. Not every single person has the same amount of fluid. So they tell you these things in a way that makes you nervous. And then it leads to more testing. And eventually it starts to bother you so much that you just get to the point where you feel like, God, I should just get my baby out. And he's offering you an induction at 39 weeks when the baby may not even be ready. And the cervix may not be ready. And the uterus certainly isn't ready because nature hasn't primed it yet. It hasn't done its thing because nature knows when things are ready most of the time. And again, we're not talking about the exception. We're talking about how this happens where you get these high induction rates and then you get these intervention rates and you get an 80% ridiculous C-section rate. So they find these things. And then they say, well, we can solve that by having the baby in the bassinet. And wouldn't you like to meet your baby? And you don't want a dead baby, do you? And of course, once they say that to somebody, then the gigs is up. And a woman is going to give in because the woman would do anything to save her baby. And she does not want to harm her baby. And doctors, unfortunately, use language that takes advantage of that. You know, we haven't mentioned the fathers yet. The fathers are like, a third appendage sometimes. They're not really involved in a lot of the systems of medicine. They sometimes get in the way. The doctors and the nurses, treat them as if they're not really part of the whole process. And so fathers end up feeling disempowered, and that can affect the relationship between men and women when a woman feels like the husband didn't stand up for her. And then that's a whole nother issue. But I just want to say that the system is geared to get these women to get on the assembly line of getting delivered. Do we really think that 40% of women need to be induced? The medical system does that. But think about that. You're saying that something that nature designed over eons in the last 50 years has fallen apart. In two generations, we've gone from a C-section rate of 5% to a 500, 600, I don't know how many percent increase in your country. That's crazy to think that that's the case. And again, no one's looking at outcomes. If the outcomes were immensely better, you could say, okay, there's a justification for raising the C-section rate and the induction rate, but the outcomes aren't better. And that's where it's really crazy.
But isn't the outcome to get the baby out?
Is it? The outcome is how is the baby? How's the baby's life? How's the mother? How's the mother feeling? How's the mother healing? How's the mother's mood? How's the mother's depression? How's the mother's bonding? What about the mother's future babies? When you do a C-section on a first baby, for even an indication where there might be a benefit to it, you've got to remember that now you've put all that mother and all that mother's future babies at risk. So it's not just a one-off. It's not just a focus on the live baby in the bassinet, but the medical model only focuses on that. And if you do a C-section on a woman who didn't need it, and when you're looking at the 80% C-section rate, I would tell you that probably 90% of those women didn't need it. So you're doing hundreds of thousands of unnecessary major surgeries a year with no concern for them downstream. And if that woman in a future pregnancy has a placental problem where the placenta grows into the uterus, it's called placenta accreta, which is increased after every cesarean section you have. No one's saying, well, let's look back and see why we did that first C-section. Oh, we didn't really need to do that. Oh, then this is our fault. No, they don't say that. They just say, well, that will save you from the accreta that we probably caused, and pat us on the back for being so good to save you from the placenta accreta. They don't see what they're doing downstream because they don't look. I'll tell you, here's a good example in my own practice. I'm an expert in breech delivery, and I support women who breech delivery. And when I was still practicing in Southern California, I've since moved to Utah, but when I was still practicing, I would see women for a consult for breech, usually around 36 to 38 weeks when they find out their baby's breech and their doctor is only giving them the option of having a cesarean section. no other option available. Doesn't mention the fact that breech birth is a reasonable choice. Maybe they don't know how to do it. So then they could say, I don't know how to do it, but you should go see somebody who does it. But they find me on their own, generally through their doula or a friend. They find about me. They come to see me for a consult. And I'll ask them this question, and I've never had anyone answer it differently. The question I ask them is, the doctor who recommended you have a C-section for this baby, did she ever ask you if you want more children? And the answer is universally no. They never even ask the question because it doesn't even enter their mindset. All that matters to them is their fear of breech. Let's get this baby out by cesarean section. By the way, the baby still has to come out breech by cesarean. So they still have to know how to deliver a breech baby. They just don't want to do it through the vagina. They'll do it through an abdominal hole instead. Just like, think about that for just a second. They don't think about the fact that down the road, that this woman may want a large family. She may want 6 children. And when she comes back with her next pregnancy, they're going to start to tell her the dangers of vaginal birth after cesarean. And they'll probably scare her into having a repeat C-section. And then what's the risk to the mother after 2 C-sections? How about after 3? How about after 4? There's no consideration for that. Those risks are far greater than the risk that you mentioned of something going wrong at a home birth in a properly chosen woman with a skilled midwife at her side. In a system that values communication, that values continuity of care, that's completely different than the medical model. You know, when you hire a midwife, you get an hour-long prenatal visit every time, not 6 to 10 minutes. You get nurturing. You get a friend. You get someone who's available for you 24/7, not a call number, not a call group, not reaching out and talking to a stranger who doesn't know you. And when you go into labor, your midwife will likely be the one that's there, as opposed to the medical model, where if your doctor's in a group of 10 doctors, you have a 1 in 10 chance of having the person that you've been seeing be your caregiver. And now you get a different nurse and a different doctor, a complete stranger. This is not how mammals feel safe. This is not how labor progresses smoothly. And so labor becomes dysfunctional. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They do things to make labor dysfunctional. Then they say, your labor is dysfunctional. We'll fix it by giving you Pitocin, without any concern about the fact that there's problems with artificial Pitocin. You know, they don't tell you that there are risks to that medication. And then, of course, the contractions get really strong. And therefore, since you have to be monitored now because you're on Pitocin, you can't move. So you have to get your epidural. And then your epidural, as I said earlier, disconnects you from your baby. I have this theory about that. And then the baby isn't connected to mom through hormonal exchange anymore, because mom is now snoring or sleeping because she's comfortable. And yet the baby's still getting squeezed every 2 to 3 minutes. And the baby doesn't know where mom is. And so the baby starts to get a little panicky, and its heart rate begins to show some fluctuations, and the doctors don't like that. And so the doctors say, well, your baby's not tolerating labor very well. I think we should do a C-section. And then you're supposed to feel relieved that you had a C-section. It all started because they were meddling with you in the first place, except in those rare occasions. Again, those maybe 10% of women, maybe 15% of women who really need the hospital model, who may need a surgical birth. But what about the others, you know, 60%? You're 70% in your country that are having C-sections that don't need it. They're all told they need it. Your question was, you know, they're all told that there's a reason for it. Of course, there's a reason for it. They're not going to be told that I'm doing it because I want to be home by dinner.
So I can play golf.
That's not the
tomorrow.
Reason that there's, but that's often the reason.
Mm. But now, I mean, something that you always hear about epidurals is, well, I mean, I don't want to go through that pain. I mean, this is a great way to reduce that fear. Just inject me.
I love this topic because labor is uncomfortable. There's no question about it. The term pain is a two-edged sword, because there is pain and then there's real pain. And when you and I have pain, we don't just sit there and take it. We move away. If we bang our elbow, we rub our elbow. It feels better when we rub our elbow. The reason it feels better is because when you bang your elbow, there's a part of your brain on the opposite side that starts to fire and says, ouch, 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 ouch. The minute you start rubbing your elbow, your brain, all those areas around that part also begin to fire, and your brain can no longer pick out the specific spot, and it feels better. Same thing when you burn your finger. You know, you put it in your mouth, or you run it under cold water. That doesn't make the burn less, but it makes it feel better because of the thing called the gate theory of pain. So when you can deal with pain that way, there's coping mechanisms. And when you understand that the surges in labor are there to help get your baby out, and when you can move, and when you can get massaged, And when you can get something called a rebozo, which is like a big scarf, and you can get your hips shimmied, when you can get in the water, when you can have shower beating down on your back when that as your labor progresses, when you can lift your leg up, when you can change positions, you can cope with pain a lot better than if someone hits you in the elbow and you're not allowed to rub your elbow. It's the same sort of thing. But here's a really important question. If people believe in evolution over time, you things that are beneficial stick around, things that are less beneficial disappear. In every mammal, labor is painful. So why is labor painful? Why wouldn't that go away? What purpose does it serve biologically that labor remains painful? Now, putting the biblical explanation aside, when a wild animal is in labor, it's not crying out and moaning and saying, fuck, all right? It's not doing those things. But it's painful, okay? Because we know that because they've done experiments on animals in labor and they can see that their catecholamine levels rise every time they have a contraction. And so we know that they're having discomfort. So maybe labor is painful because there's a benefit to it. Because if there was no benefit to it, then over time you'd think it would evolve away, but it hasn't. So what could that benefit be? Because when you have a surge and you're uncomfortable, you're putting out neurotransmitters and hormones that help you cope with that. You're putting out cortisol, which is your stress hormone. You're putting out adrenaline, which helps you because it helps to space contractions out a little bit and prepares your body to fight or flight. You're putting out endorphins, which are your body's own opiates to help you deal with pain. And you're putting out oxytocin, obviously, surges of oxytocin every few minutes, which not only makes your uterus contract, but also makes you feel warm and love and connection to your baby, connection to your partner. It's a hormone that helps with milk letdown, although that's not relevant at that time. You're putting out that whole cocktail of hormones. And every 3 minutes or so, you put out a surge, and then you have a couple minutes to recover, and the receptors recover and regenerate, and then you put out another surge, and then another surge of these hormones. But think about this. When you're having discomfort, you're not the only person that's having discomfort. Your baby is also experiencing something for the first time that it's never experienced before. And its whole world is changing because its whole world has been living inside of mom, minding its own business, floating around, doing its thing, communicating with mom back and forth. When mom is happy, baby's happy. When mom is nervous, probably baby gets the same hormones that mom's putting out and baby gets a little nervous and that sort of thing. When mom eats food that's not so good, baby knows it. When mom eats sugar, baby knows it, that sort of thing. So there's a communication going on between mom and baby throughout the entire time. Baby's giving mom some of its own cells. Every mom has is a chimera of cells that from every child she ever conceived is living inside that woman. So there's a communication and a beautiful symphony that's going on between mom and baby. So every time that baby is getting squeezed every 3 minutes, that baby's getting a waft of mom's hormones. There's mom's oxytocin. Mom is there. Mom loves me. I'm feeling warmth. There's mom's adrenaline. That's helping me cope with my contraction. There's mom's endorphins. Wow, that feels pretty good. Okay. And it's coping fine. Then the woman gets an epidural and suddenly all those hormones are shut off because she's no longer in pain. Yet her contractions are still continuing, and maybe even they've spaced out a little bit from the epidural, so now they add Pitocin. So now the baby is getting squeezed without any help from mom anymore. And then the baby's heart rate changes that we've discussed earlier. So maybe labor is painful for a reason, and maybe we're supposed to try to deal with that pain in the way every other mammal does and not artificially make it go away with gas or an epidural. And I'm not saying that epidurals aren't a godsend. Of course, they're a godsend for some women. But an 80% epidural rate for women who labor is crazy. Let them move. One of the best things a woman can do is hire a doula who keeps her at home until she's almost ready to push if she really wants to birth in a hospital. Because getting to the hospital early is one of the worst mistakes you can possibly make because they will not leave you alone. They will interrupt you. They will. You're not moving fast enough for them. They'll want to do vaginal exams, completely unnecessary. In the home birth world, I was taught by midwives, and it took me a while to unlearn a lot of the doctor stuff that I learned in my, in my residency, in my first 5 or 10 years in practice, that vaginal exams are often unnecessary, most often unnecessary. The reason they're done is because of a silly thing that happened, something called the Friedman curve, which was a curve that was designed in the 60s, I believe, maybe the 70s, by a man named Emanuel Friedman, who came up with a labor curve. Now, a labor curve is something that, all first-time moms should dilate at such and such a rate. Here's an average rate. And the average rate is about a centimeter an hour. Well, how do you know if she's dilating a centimeter an hour unless you're sticking your fingers in and checking? So vaginal exams became routine. But the other stupid thing about it is that that line that they drew is a median, which means that half of all women labored slower than that, and half of all women labored faster than that. And yet, if women are laboring slower than that, which is about 50% of women who would labor slower than that, that's considered abnormal. Do you understand how foolish that is? And those women got intervened upon. They weren't moving fast enough. We need to break your bag of waters. We need to start Pitocin. You're not moving fast enough. Since when is speed a value that nature desires? It's a speed is an artificial value that's been put in by the medical community. What difference does it make if a woman laboring for 12 hours or 22 hours? If that's what nature designed for her and everything else is going fine.
So you're saying induction should be left also to the mother?
No. I'm saying that medical, there are medical reasons to be induced and they need to be explained to the mother. And ultimately, by the way, it's still the mother's choice to do it or not. When a doctor says your baby isn't growing well, and I think it should come out, the woman has the right to get a second opinion. The woman has the right to say, I understand what you're saying, doctor, but I think my baby's doing fine. I can feel my baby moving. I'm feeling that my baby's fine. And that woman may be wrong. And she has to accept the fact that if she's declining recommendations, that she has to accept the consequences of her actions. And a lot of times, because of the legal system in my country, probably your country as well, women choose not to follow the directions. And then when something goes wrong, they want to blame somebody else for it. That has to stop, too. That's a problem. That's part of the reason the medical model is so intervention happy. Because of the fears of liability. It's a very complex web that's been woven that drives these things. And again, the individual doctor is really stuck just in that matrix and cannot get out. But here's another clue about your obstetrician. How does your obstetrician treat you when you ask a question? Do they look at you with make eye contact, or are they busy typing into their EMR system? Do they roll their eyes when you say something like, you know, I really want to do this with pain-free. I don't want any medication. Do they get in a huff if you decline their recommendation? Do they storm out of the room? Do they try using coercion or the dead baby card on you? And I'll tell you what's really important about that, because it tells you a lot about human nature. Because happy people do not treat other people badly. Unhappy people treat other people badly. So if you feel like your doctor is treating you badly or that you're not being treated like a normal human being, you can pretty much assume that your doctor is unhappy. Why is your doctor unhappy? Well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, it could be their personal life, but most likely they're unhappy because they're stuck in this stupid matrix. Doing volume practice with very little reward, long hours, constant scrutiny by third parties who are just looking over their shoulder, waiting for them to screw up, not seeing their job through this whole shift mentality means that you don't get to see the completion of your project. Because for me as a physician, the woman that I'm caring for the 7 months that she's in my care, when I missed a delivery because I was out of town or because the hospital didn't call me in time, I was extremely upset by that. That was my ego being hurt. That's not something that should come into play that much, but it does, because I wanted to see the culmination of my work. And when you work a shift, you obviously care less than you would if you're responsible for that person all the way through. Again, it's another flaw in the system of flaws that I've been reiterating for the last almost an hour already.
You were talking about the unnecessary need for so many vaginal examinations, for example, but does that apply to other examinations, like, for example, all the scans?
Yeah, most scans are unnecessary. A woman can give birth to a baby without an ultrasound. Let that sink in for a second. You could have a pregnancy where you have no ultrasounds and give birth to a baby. Ultrasound, again, like cesarean section, like epidurals, they're a godsend when necessary and when they find something. But the routine use of ultrasound is on a mission creep. It used to be that maybe you had a 20-week ultrasound to look at the baby's anatomy. Now they want you to have a 12-week ultrasound. They want you to have a 20-week ultrasound. They want you to have a 30-week, 32-week ultrasound. They want you to have a 36-week ultrasound. And if they find anything, then they want you to have an ultrasound twice a week, and they want you to be tested, and they want you to do all these things. And most of that stuff doesn't change the outcomes. Look at where we are with outcomes again. So what have we done? It's kind of like the same thing that's happened with mammograms and pap smears. We were taught that you need an annual pap smear and you need an annual mammogram. Again, gaslit. There's no evidence to support that annual mammograms actually lowers the rate of cancer death. that's, you know, let that sink in for a second, because we were always taught that if you catch cancer early and you remove it early and mammograms will catch cancers earlier than breast self-exam, your survival would be better. But that's not been proven to be true.
I think one of the things that sort of makes sense, though, is you can't see into her body. So the scan kind of makes you feel better about things, you know, and then I suppose at like 35, 36 weeks, you're now wanting to see if the baby is beginning to engage, you know, that sort of thing, or the placenta scan. Are all those things unnecessary too?
Most of the time they're unnecessary, yes. But there are pros and cons to doing that. There's a great reassurance factor of seeing a woman seeing her baby and seeing that the baby looks normal. The problem is if who's doing the ultrasound. When you go to a maternal medicine, fetal medicine doctor, they see birth through the prism of pregnancy itself is a high-risk condition. And therefore, they are looking for things to be wrong. And even if everything looks normal and there's one little thing, like a little dilated ventricle in the brain, they're going to focus on that. And that's the only thing the woman's going to leave the doctor's office hearing, is that my baby's perfectly normal, but there's this one little thing, which probably doesn't mean anything, but he wants to see me back in 6 weeks. So now for 6 weeks, I'm thinking about this one thing, which turns out that it's not there anymore at 6 weeks. But now you've been worrying and bathing your baby in worry hormones for 6 weeks, all because you had an ultrasound by an MFM who, you know, his job is to find things that are wrong. People have to understand when they're going into these things that there's pros and cons to these tests. And there's a lot of false positives with the things we do, with things like diabetes screening and group B strep screening and all that stuff. These things they lead to more interventions. And there was a paper that came out, and I can't remember when, but that said when you have a third trimester ultrasound, like at 36 weeks, that the rate of interventions and the rate of cesarean section goes up by 20-30%, simply because you had the ultrasound, because they find something that then leads to more somethings. It leads to more worry and more testing and eventually induction and eventually failed induction and eventually a cesarean section, simply because they looked and they saw something like, oh, the fluid was a little on the low side. Well, that's normal. Some babies have fluid a little on the low side.
Yeah.
Is it nice to know where the placenta is? Yeah, it's nice to know where the placenta is. But again, the skill of putting your hands on and palpation, which midwives still possess, you don't need an ultrasound to tell you what position your baby's in, and you don't need an ultrasound to tell you if your baby's engaged or not. Skilled hands can easily tell you that, but they don't teach skilled hands anymore.
Right.
Just like they don't teach breech delivery anymore. They don't teach twin vaginal delivery anymore. They just go right to cesarean section because they don't understand the mechanisms. They don't understand the importance that a woman puts on giving birth vaginally. It's not important to the medicalized birth model. And so everything they do, again, is designed, as you said earlier, what was it? Revenue and fear. Right.
Part of that over-medicalization, which I have come to consider a waste of time, and I don't think it adds any value, is vitamin K and the early vaccines, for example. I am now fairly skeptical of those interventions as well. Am I correct in that skepticism?
You should be, yes. First of all, let's talk about a couple of things. First of all, the erythromycin eye goop. Your spouse, the women are screened for chlamydia and gonorrhea. If they don't have it, they don't need this eye goop in their eyes, which, you know, is an antibiotic, first of all. Of course, the medical system doesn't believe there's any downside to antibiotics. They just give them way too often. And we've created all kinds of problems with antibiotics, including affecting the microbiome and creating superbugs and all that stuff. So that's ridiculous to give to a woman who's got negative cultures or, you know, who's been having prenatal care. There's no reason to give the eye goop. Let's talk about hepatitis vaccine, because that's an easy one. There's zero indication to give hepatitis vaccine unless a woman has hepatitis. And even then, the vaccine isn't going to help the baby. What they need is hepatitis B immune globulin, because the vaccine takes a while to work and the baby's going to be exposed to hepatitis at birth. But all women are screened for hepatitis in pregnancy and all women are negative. I mean, almost all women are negative. And yet they want to give a baby a vaccine for a disease that's sexually transmitted or given or passes through IV drug abuse, none of which I think your baby will be involved in the first couple few years of its life. So it is a moneymaker. They don't consider it to be a downside. It has 250 micrograms of aluminum in it. Aluminum is a toxin. There is no safe dose of heavy metals in humans, let alone fetuses or newborns. So the hepatitis vaccine is an absolute no, unless you have hepatitis. And the problem now with giving HBIG, which is hepatitis B immune globulin, is that it comes from pooled blood specimens. And there's no way to know whether those pooled blood specimens were people that got the COVID vaccine and are putting spike protein into that. So we got a real problem now with our blood supply and those sorts of things, Rogam transfusions. You know, those it's a real problem for those of those people who decided that they wanted to wait and find out, as we are all finding out now that they were the smart ones, the people that avoided the pressures and the censoring and the tyranny of their governments to avoid getting. Those were the brave people that stood out. As vitamin K is a real interesting thing because there is something called vitamin K deficiency bleeding, which is quite severe and can happen. But the incidence of that happening is about six out of 100,000. So it's about 1 in 16,000, give or take. So we're giving vitamin K to prevent something that happens 1 in 16,000. We're giving it intramuscularly rather than subcutaneously or orally when there's a black box warning on the package insert for vitamin K to say, don't give it intramuscularly because it causes anaphylactic reaction. And yet it's given intramuscularly in babies. I'm still not sure why that is. But just like, why is labor painful? Let's ask the question, if vitamin K is so important for babies, then how come babies are born vitamin K deficient? Wouldn't nature have figured out a way to give babies vitamin K? And why is it?
The cutting of the umbilical cord.
That may be part of it. But my point is this, 15,999 babies don't get vitamin K deficiency bleeding, and they're vitamin K deficient. So why are we giving them a shot to protect that one baby that might have something else wrong with it? And why are we giving them something that's going to thicken their clotting and increase their clotting when maybe nature designed it so that in the first week or so of life, until the baby's gut starts to produce its own vitamin K through its own colonization of bacteria, that healthy mother's vaginal bacteria, maybe it's not supposed to be thickened. Maybe blood is supposed to flow thinner. Maybe it's supposed to flow into tiny little capillaries forming in the baby's brain and other parts of its body. And maybe that's why nature designed it that way. Again, the medical model believes somehow that nature is a lousy obstetrician, to quote Errol Norwich, a professor here in the United States. One of the dumbest things I think I've ever heard anyone say is that nature is a lousy obstetrician. Well, thank God for nature. Because I mean, obstetricians are lousy caregivers to women, most women. And so, but the idea that we have vitamin K, we're giving it to all these babies. And in some states in my country, it's even mandated. People don't understand that you can decline a mandate. You can decline to have that in your baby. You might be threatened with Child Protective Services and other things like that, and you have to stand your ground for that. Or you have to move to a state where they're not going to do that for you and get out of those tyrannical places. But the idea that these other women, these other babies, excuse me, need vitamin K, and maybe we're doing something detrimental to them. But no one stops to think about it because you know why, Germ? Because there's no money in not giving vitamin K.
Yeah.
There's no money in not giving hepatitis vaccine. There's no money in not putting erythromycin eye goop in the eye. You don't get to pay. You don't get to bill for that. But all those other things you get to bill for, even though they don't make sense. So I want, you know, I would love to have your listeners just stop and think for a second about everything that they've been told and try to step out of the matrix for a second and look down and say, why is my baby going to the warmer after I just gave birth to it? Why isn't it up here connected to its cord on my skin? Why are they taking it over there? Why am I getting blood drawn when I show up at the hospital in labor? It's just routinely done. No one even questions it. But a woman who gives birth at home doesn't have blood drawn when the midwife show up at her house. She gives birth without blood being drawn. Why are they drawing blood? Well, they'll say, well, we have to know what your hemoglobin is. Well, why? I'm fine. I've been fine all along. It's not a problem. Well, we have to have a tube of blood in the blood bank just in case you hemorrhage and we need to transfuse you. Well, what do you do if somebody comes in with a car accident? You give them O negative blood if you have to, or you cross match them really quickly. They draw these things and it's routinely drawn simply because they can bill for it. Now that's a radical statement to say that, but you know, some women need it if they have, you know, if they have high blood pressure, they're ruling out preeclampsia but to routinely make a woman pee in a cup and draw blood and send it to the lab on every single woman that comes in the hospital to make them change into a hospital gown. What does the hospital gown symbolize? It symbolizes
something wrong.
That you're a patient.
Yeah.
Right. Jim Gaffigan, the comedian, I don't know if you know who he is in South Africa, but he says something, why do I want my wife to put on a hospital gown that someone died in yesterday? You know, okay. So, you know, I mean, but why can't they wear their own jammies or be naked or whatever they want to do? Why do they have to do these things? Why do they have routine blood pressure checks? If a woman comes in and her blood pressure is normal in labor and she doesn't have any symptoms during labor of being hypotensive, then what's the odds that her blood pressure is going to change in labor to a significant point where you have to do something? Almost zero. Yet they have to do it because the policies of the hospital state, we have to chart this. And if the nurse doesn't chart it, then the nurse gets yelled at. So the nurse just does what she's told. Again, like the doctors, the nurses are cogs in the wheel of a system that's being driven by who knows who. Nobody knows who's really driving the system, but it is financially driven.
I think it was something that you might have said in one of your podcasts that, as I told you before we were recording, my wife and I were listening to a bunch of your shows on a road trip recently. And I think it was you that said, you go to hospital because there's something wrong. When you're giving birth, is there something wrong? And that just blew my mind because I had never thought of it like that. No, there's nothing wrong when you're giving birth. So why are you going to the hospital?
Because we've been culturally indoctrinated to believe that, like ACOG says in one of their guidelines, it says birth itself, or pregnancy itself, is a high risk condition. We've been trained over generations, probably the last 100 years or so, that medicine has been industrialized to believe again that birth is a problem and needs to go to the hospital. And there is nothing else that you go to the hospital for wellness. I mean, you might go for your routine checkups, or you might go for a lecture, a community lecture on something like that, you know, but otherwise hospitals are places where you go when you need treatment for something. So therefore, by going to a hospital and putting on the hospital gown, as you mentioned earlier, it's a disempowerment thing. It makes you believe that you are sick and that you need to be treated, and you have that mindset and you can't get out of it there. And there are ways to get normal, natural birthing in a hospital or vaginal birthing in a hospital, but it's not going to be physiologic, because physiologic birth requires the mammal to be by itself, safe, quiet, unobserved, unfettered. Ultimately, women are designed to give birth completely by themselves. Obviously, you know, because our brains don't let us think like that anymore, we want a guide to be nearby. We want somebody trained nearby. That makes good sense. But I'm not opposed to women who have little choices and decide to free birth. The medical community, my obstetrical community, would just cringe at the idea of free birthing. It's something that's been brought on by their tyranny.
Yeah.
Most women would not choose to free birth. But when you make laws that say midwives can't help me, or that, you know, I can't have a skilled person in my house because it's illegal for, you know, I could have a taxi driver deliver my baby, but I can't have a board, you know, a licensed midwife or a certified nurse midwife deliver my baby because of the laws in my state or my community. That's crazy. What a woman needs when she's in labor is supportive community, people there that are supportive of her. Anybody that's there that's not supportive of her, that's nervous, should not be there. And the caregivers should be like my friend Alex, my midwife friend Alex says, should be like lifeguard ninjas. So they should be just watching from afar and only stepping in when there's a shark sighting or when there's a riptide, and leaving you on the beach to do what you want and enjoy your day and not even know that the lifeguard is there. That would be the ideal scenario. Hire somebody like that to be with you at your birth. Hospitals just aren't going to allow that to happen. They just aren't. You're going to have to fight for everything that you need to. And if you feel safer in a hospital, then it's a fight worth having, because there's nothing more important in a woman's life in general. Again, I'm generally speaking as a male. I would tell you that it doesn't matter that I'm a male saying this, that giving birth to your child is probably the most important life event that you will have. You know, your wedding is probably a close second, but a woman on her deathbed will maybe not remember the names of her children or anything like that, but she'll remember giving birth. Because that sticks with women always. And we want women to have good memories. And not a lot of women have good memories. There's a lot of trauma out there, not just overt violent trauma, but just trauma from mistreatment. Mm. When women are surveyed about, you know, their birth scenario, the of the women that report trauma in their birth, 2/3 of them say it's from how they were treated up here, not physical violence. So we need to be better at that. We need to understand that this is something that women should value. And women need to understand that if you value this, then put some time and effort into it. Save some money when you're younger. Put money in a savings account to use and spend on your birth to get the kind of birth that you want. If you have to hire a private doctor or a private midwife or go to a private, don't just assume that because you have a national health card that you're going to have to take whatever the national health system gives you. You don't have to do that. The government, you know, there's an analogy we use a lot about the wedding analogy and how we spend a lot of our money on a wedding and we plan everything. You plan the color of the dresses, you plan the, you know, the texture of the napkins, you plan the tasting of the cake, you invite people to the wedding that you like, you pick the venue, you do all these things and you spend a lot of money on it. But for your birth, you abdicate all that to a third party. You know, what if you had wedding insurance and your wedding was paid for, but you didn't get to invite people you liked and you had it at a venue you didn't like and you couldn't have the chicken, you could only have the fish and you didn't get to pick the color of the napkins. You know, who would do that? No one would do that for their wedding, yet we do it for the birth, which is probably, again, the most important event in our lives. We just abdicate it to a third party. Got to stop thinking like that. We've got to stop. We've been indoctrinated for 100 years to think this way. Women have to take their power back. And I'm just a vessel. I stand on the coattails of all the midwives and all the brilliant people that came before me. I'm not this person because I just thought all this stuff up myself. Some of it is me, but I've learned from all the granny midwives, and I was open to hearing what they had to tell me. And I've been able to assimilate that information into something that makes much more sense to me and the people that I talk to. And there are some people who will never get past their fear. And for them, the hospital is a godsend. And I totally understand that. But then you have to, then you get what you get. And if you go to a hospital in South Africa, you're going to get your 80% C-section rate. And if you want four or five kids, you're going to have to deal with trying to fight for a VBAC or have four or five C-sections. And each one is more complicated than the next. And the recovery can be a little bit harder. And there's more complications for you and your baby down the road. And you have to think about that. You have to plan ahead. You have to put value on it. If you put value on it, then you'll put time on it. Because, you know, we give our energy to things we value.
I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to invite you back for round two. There's so much more I want to chat to you about. And I'd love to have you back on because I think this is going to be very, very popular.
It's going to be controversial, I think, Jerm, which makes it popular, I think, because I know that what I say will rock a lot of boats. It will. It'll make people uncomfortable. The problem is when you make people uncomfortable, their response is often not to say, maybe I've been wrong. The response is to say that guy's crazy.
Yeah.
Because it's just easier to do that. Mm. But I challenge people to think out of their box because this is again, birth is the greatest thing. I mean, this is your first child you're going to have?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, God. You know, it's just the best. Mm. And it's why we're here.
How can I follow you?
I don't have really a presence on YouTube. We do have a YouTube channel, but we don't ever deal with it. I'm on Instagram at Birthing Instincts. My website is birthinginstincts.com. And my podcast is called Birthing Instincts. So it's not hard. Everything is Birthing Instincts. That's where people will find me. Bliss and I, my co-host on my podcast, have been doing this now for a while. I started this podcast in 2013, I think long before podcasting was a big thing. And it's evolved to a point now where I just love doing it. It gives me a way to reach out to a larger audience. And I hope that people, if they have questions, they can reach out to that. We also have a Patreon community that we've started. We've got over 500 people in it. We started it about 6 months ago. And we're trying to develop a community of like-minded moms, dads, doulas, birth workers, anybody who wants to join. Hopefully OBs will join at some point. And to look at birth and look at health in another way with like-minded people so you don't feel so alone. And they can find that through my website. There's a link there. And also on Instagram on my link tree. At Birthing Instincts. So that's how people will find me.
Let me just add to what you were saying now. As I said earlier, my wife and I were listening to multiple podcasts of yours and they were extremely enlightening and shall I say, red pilling. So I really, really do appreciate the work that you've put in.
Well, the fact that you reached out to me from across the world is, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I'm just honored to have the opportunity to do this. And I'm really excited for you and your journey over the next 3 months as you see the culmination of this and see the birth of your child. And I hope that you guys get the birth that you want, the birth that you deserve.
Dr. Stu, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportgerm.com.